Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street. And
Dr. Mark Scholl's with us, MD. He is the co-author, Invasion of the Prostate Snatches, an essential guide to managing prostate cancer for patients and their families. And he's been a he's been treating men with prostate cancer exclusively since 1995. He's a board certified in medical oncology and internal medicine and is the medical director of Prostate Oncology Specialist, Inc. He is the executive director of the Prostate Cancer Research Institute. Mark, I welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael, for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Mark, when we take a look at prostate cancer, from what I understand, I'm not a clinician, and please stop me if I'm wrong, every man's going to get it, and then they probably are going to have it. Not necessarily you could be 80 or 90 years old before it's going to happen, but one way or the other, from what I understand, it's going to happen.
Absolutely true. They've done autopsy studies on poor old gents that have died in car accidents, and when they look for it, they find it in practically everybody.
Yeah. Now, by the way, now what is prostate cancer? Let's start with the base and say this is what it is, and let's work our way up from there.
Well, let's just keep it simple so that we give you all some useful information. Think of it like two different illnesses with the same name, prostate cancer. There's the type that creates havoc and kills people, although maybe not as bad as other cancers. And then there's the quiet, non-malignant type that just sits there and doesn't do anything. What everyone's confused about is they call them both by the same name.
Oh, okay. So one's dangerous, one really isn't.
Correct.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the dangerous one for a moment. What are some of the symptoms? What are some of the things that men have to start watching out for as, I'm going to say, we get a little older?
No symptoms at all. And this is, you kind of have to rely on techie blood tests, needle biopsies, scans, and expert advice to let you know when you got the one that needs treatment. You can't, you're not going to feel anything, thank God. I mean, it's usually a painless condition, but it can sneak up on people if they don't do their PSA testing.
All right, so a PSA testing, is that something that should be an annual testing? When should that happen?
Well, in my opinion, it should, and in the opinion of most doctors, it should. There are some people who think that PSA testing is causing more harm than good because it leads to a biopsy, and then they find these little, you know, the good type of prostate cancer. Everyone gets all frightened and rushes into surgery, and they end up being impotent and incontinent for the rest of their life, maybe treatment that they never needed in the first place. So PSA is a double-edged sword. I recommend doing it, but you do have to use the information circumspectly.
Okay, now let's say, for instance, I'm a middle-aged kind of guy. We won't tell anybody. I'm going to be 69 in a couple months. But I stay in really good shape. But the concern is that I, like anybody else, this can happen to me. Is there anything I can do for prevention or maybe to stall it off? Is there nutrition? Is there any kind of exercise? What can I do to do a little bit of a preventative?
The answer is it's the same bad news with heart disease. In other words, eat a very good diet and exercise, and you definitely cut your risk of prostate cancer. It's just that, you know, avoiding the hamburgers and the vanilla malts and the French fries is not always fun.
No, not at all. But basically, so you watch yourself, you eat well, you make sure you get some exercise in there, and you go from there. But now let's go to somebody gets it. When I have found in my experience doing the interviews all these years that when there is a disease or something that's debilitating, there's an accident, there's a something, the person that has it, that's one thing, but the entire house has it because everybody who's related that lives with that person is affected by what the problem is. So really, prostate cancer or anything else, when it affects one, it affects the entire family.
You're absolutely right. And people that have the bad type, I think sometimes, since the illness is usually not physically painful, there are exceptions. I think the greatest pain that patients go through is they see the anxiety and the worry and the emotional trauma to their family. I think that's probably the worst pain.
Oh, no question about it. Now, let's say, for instance, somebody comes in, they sit down with you, and you diagnose them. Is there any kind of a backup where the family in and of themselves can be consulted with this? Is there any kind of a support group for the family with those people who do have prostate cancer?
Yeah, the whole process, Michael, is an educational one. First, this making this distinction between the good types and the bad types. And then as the process unfolds, everyone has to kind of make some hard decisions, because there's always going to be an in-between gray zone where people truly wonder whether they should have treatment, which has all kinds of problems, or whether they should simply watch it. And the process is not only educating the patient himself, but the family and everyone else involved, because everyone gets frightened when they hear the word cancer.
And by the way, then the first thing, and especially with prostate cancer, the first thing that we're talking about is the operation, you know, and we know what some of the side effects are. It affects your sex life and so many other things. But are there alternatives? You know, we keep hearing that's really the be-all, end-all, quote-unquote.
You know why, Michael, we hear it's the be-all, end-all? The old saying is, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And the unique thing about the prostate cancer world is that we have surgeons, not prostate cancer experts, not medical oncologists treating this illness. So is it any surprise, then, that surgery is the number one recommendation when you have surgeons making all the diagnosis? They're the ones that do the biopsy. They're the ones that catch the baby when it comes out, and they tell you the name of what's going on, and everyone trusts them. And when they say surgery, that's what everyone runs to. Now, in my opinion, I'm not a surgeon. I think some of the other options, in fact, almost any option is better than surgery. There's radiation treatments, hormone treatments, monitoring without treatment, immune treatments. Almost anything you pick, it's going to be better than surgery.
Okay, so effectively, with all of these options, but somebody comes in to sit down and talk to you, how do we know what the best option is? Because everybody obviously is an individual. Everybody's going to have it from one degree to another degree. And not all medical doctors are versed in every subject matter. So would we be seeing a specialist? And how do we know what's the best thing for us?
Well, this is partly why I wrote the book, of course, because I see a real, in the whole country, there's only about 100 doctors that are doing what I'm doing. And we're getting 200,000 new cases every single year. So the savvy patients, they start making calls, they get on the internet, they start talking, they get multiple consultations, and they educate themselves. The not-so-savvy patients, they just listen to the first expert, and they get the treatment that expert gives.
Okay, well, and I think if we go all the way back, Mark, what we look at is this. I remember the old days when the doctor came to your house, they had a little black bag. That was real stuff, and they did that. And I remember being, you know, a patient of a doctor who did those kind of things. But as it grew, the doctor became the be-all, end-all. Most people, when they walk into a doctor's office, they're frightened because they've got a symptom of something, they don't know what it is, and they don't want to die. So whatever the doctor says is what you do, because you're afraid not to do it. That was then. We are looking at a different world today whereby we question, and it's almost a joint interview, quote unquote, to see if that doctor is the right doctor for us.
You have to. If medicine is becoming a business, it's becoming a big business. And honestly, I hate to lower. I'm a physician myself, but if you go into to buy a new car, you don't just take the first car that they offer you. You know that salesman, his job is to sell you that car, not the car for the guy down the street. And it's not maybe quite that bad, but I'll tell you, there is that component of doctors want you to do the treatment that they give. So you have to be on your guard out there, and you have to shop around, and you have to talk to multiple experts.
Now, by the way, the book in and of itself, I think a book like this should truly be part of a high school curriculum. And the reason for that is this. It's going to happen someday, or it may happen to someone you know. Know about it beforehand. Prep when you're 14, 15, 18, 20 years old. So when you do get to the age where it, you know, the average person gets it, then the problem can be addressed in a completely different way. You may not be able to stop it, but you can sure slow it down and work on the effects of it.
Well, Michael, that is just really warms my heart. Our hope was that we could reach an audience before some doctor is sitting across the table telling you you have cancer. At that point, your brain goes into freezing mode. People are so frightened they can't even think straight. People need to hear this message before the shoe drops, at a time they can still think clearly and they can learn about prostate cancer when it's not a personal threat.
No question about it. Now, we're starting to run out of time, Mark. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website that we can find you at?
Yes, a couple of them. Prostateoncology.com. If you just Google prostate oncology, we come up number one. And I run a nonprofit educational foundation called the Prostate Cancer Research Institute. So you can go to PCRI.org, or just Google PCRI. And there's lots of info about prostate cancer. The PCRI is basically an educational foundation to try and help people hear all their options and know all the choices before they make a decision.
By the way, Mark, can we buy the book on the website?
I don't think so, actually, but it is on Amazon, and you can also get it on their little Kindle version as well if you're interested.
Oh, great. Mark Schultz, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time. The book is great. I got it in my hands here.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it very much.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Okay, bye-bye. Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me. I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Russell Shippey with us. He's the author of Our Journey is Our Work, Creating My Obituary, A Guide to Personal Growth. He spent 30 years as an insurance agent, but when he got sick, he began to question his life and he questioned his career. And now he helps others to clarify their life goals and leap forward into rewarding new lives and value meaning. Russell, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
By the way, did I pronounce your last name right?
Yes, you did, Shippey.
Wonderful. Oh, got it. No, we're good. We're on the same page. We're in good shape here. Now, by the way, I think that in and of itself, creating my obituary, a guide to personal growth, wouldn't it be interesting if I sat down tonight and created what I wanted said on my obituary? What if I sat down tonight and I projected 10, 15, 20 years out, and I had there was a party in my honor, and I wrote down everything I wanted them to say about me, and now I got 20 or 30 years to make it happen. I think you're spot on with just in your bio, it says a lot.
Thank you, Michael. And I think you're right also. And it would be a wonderful thing to have a party now and come as you will be 20 years from today.
Yeah.
Because no, I think we live to our vision.
Yeah. And what do you think? Do you think most people, Russell, don't realize that you need a vision to be able to capture what it is you want to be, who you want to be, where you want to be? Because if you don't know, how's anybody else going to know?
Too many people have given up control of their lives to other people who tell them what they should do. They have a job. They don't realize that they are, in fact, self-employed. They may, in fact, be renting themselves out to a particular corporation for a wage, but they are self-employed, and they can change, and the corporation that hires them can change. But it takes a long time for some of us to realize that we are, in fact, in control of our lives. And if we look forward to what we want that obituary to be, we have to know what it is to know where we're going and what we have to do each day. Thoreau said, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation and go to their graves with their music still in them.
Yeah.
Well, Michael, I have people write their obituary as it exists today. And the reason I do that is because most people, in taking the time to write their obituary as of today, most people are dissatisfied, Michael. They haven't done, they haven't accomplished what they wanted to do or what they felt they had the potential to do. So by writing it today, we'll empower and inspire you to move forward and realize your obituary is your report card. You are going to have one. It's non-optional. You're going to have it, and you have the opportunity to look at it today and to make it something that you're proud of and that your family's proud of.
Now, by the way, Russell, if I was sitting, I think this is critical. Let me jump in just for a second. If I was sitting in an audience and I listened to those words, I probably think it. And let me finish the whole thing. If I was in a disappointing kind of a career, if I was in a disappointing kind of a life, I'd sit there and say, "Yeah, right. It's okay for you to say it, but you know what about me?" But what you have along with the book is the workbook, and in the workbook is the step-by-step process to bring you there. So if you're going to tell me I can do this, and I'm going to say, "Yeah, right, sure, okay for you to say." But then if you say, here's the steps to do it, now all of a sudden it's practical and the light bulb goes on.
Correct, Michael. And the steps, once somebody guides you through and you take the workbook, your life is an overwhelming subject to you, or to most people.
Yeah.
But by just going through a methodical process that others have gone through, all of a sudden, it comes together, and it's not difficult. And the questions help you to see yourself, to see what your unique abilities are, to see what motivates and excites you. I always say, what would you do if you weren't paid, Michael? You know, you have to have a reason to get up in the morning. And too many people get up and they go to work on a Monday morning, and they self-medicate drinking or eating all week long. And, you know, on Monday, they say only 5 days left before the weekend. Well, every day should be lived and enjoyed. And you shouldn't go to work on a Monday morning thinking it's drudgery. I only have 5 more days till I have some free time. But people do that.
No question about it. But Radio Susie's over there laughing. She's saying, "Yeah, right, sure." She did, but I think the interesting point is this: you ask a question. You said, you know, if you weren't getting paid, what would you be doing? In my life, you and I would be talking right now, doing what we're doing at this moment. And I think that's the key: is most people haven't found what it is that they would like to do. Somebody asked me, I don't know, some months ago, you know, what are you going to do when you retire? And I said, what do you mean retire? I don't work. I haven't worked in years. This is not work. And I think that's the transition when they get to the point where you're not working. Yes, it can get busy. There's no question about it. But would I trade it? Absolutely not.
Well, that really is the key. And I always tell people I was conceived to be the fourth generation in a family business. And it took me over 40 years to realize that it was my life and not the life that was created and expected of me because of the family business.
Yeah.
And I realized that if I continued, it was in fact going to kill me. And it had caused illness and, you know, physical problems as well as mental frustration doing that which I didn't love. And it made me realize how much more there was. But there are a lot of people out there today working very hard, Michael, just to keep food on the table and pay the mortgages. I'm not saying walk in tomorrow morning and quit your job. What I'm saying is continue with your job, but start to do some self-discovery as to what works for you. Try it out. Do something part-time. Take some courses. Pick up a mentor that can help guide you. You may want to stop part-time in another business, but most people can't just up and quit what they're doing right now. But they can take a baby step every day towards something new, which is exciting and empowering for them.
Now, by the way, and that in and of itself is exciting, the baby step, the take a look at what is it that you want to do? What would really make you happy? And if you don't know, make a list. You know, and I think really when it comes down to it, Russell, it's not what we don't know. It's what we don't know that we don't know. And most people don't know that they don't know that they can change their lives. It's a simple mindset. That's really what it is. It's a shift in the way you think.
Michael, you are 100% correct.
Now, Go ahead.
Well, people need to start to become aware of it and take those steps and sort of get out of the mindset as to what they do know, because often what they do know stops them from moving forward, and there's a bright world out there for each and every one of us.
There's that old adage about thinking outside the box that everybody's heard over and over and over and over again. But Russell, what that really means, the definition of that is this. We all pretty much think the same thoughts. We scramble around with them, and then we end up thinking pretty much the same thing. Thinking outside the box is thinking thoughts you didn't think you could think. That's thinking outside the box. Moving into an area of yourself that you didn't even know was there. And there's nothing that you can't think if you want to do it. Most people are frightened to death to make the change. What is that saying? You know, better unhappy than unsure. I don't believe that. But there's so many people who do that. By the way, with the insurance business, I'll tell you what the insurance business did for me. In 1963, I went to work for Washington National Life Insurance on a debit in South Central Los Angeles. We were collecting 50, 75 cents a day, you know, health insurance. I learned to be fast. I got from that house.
I bet you did, Michael.
Yeah, we got quick. But the point of contention is this, is that, and you were in it too, and I didn't realize the symbology of what I did. I went on to, I went to work for Lincoln National Life in Beverly Hills, California, and then on to own my own fire and casualty agency. But that was many, many years ago. But the point of contention is this. You got people, and I think you were in the same position when you looked at the symbology of it. Here I am dealing with life, and I didn't know what life was all about.
That's correct, Michael. It took illness and a vivid dream for me to truly wake up and see what was in fact out there. And it took me so long, and I so enjoyed the process once I started doing it. And people said, you know, how could you dare to sell your business? How could you dare to do those things, your financial security? Well, I couldn't not do it, and I saw enough of the vision of where I was going, I knew that I just had to go there. And I like to tell the story of Michelangelo painting the Sistine Chapel. He saw that whole ceiling before he picked up the paintbrush. We do everything twice. We do it in our mind's eye. We see it, we visualize it, and then we live to it, we go to it, or we create it. So often today, people won't look in their mind's eye, they won't visualize, they won't take the time to allow themselves to look at who and what they want to be, how to best use their own particular unique abilities. And you're right, we're all quite a bit the same. We all want to give back, but there's different ways for us to give back, and that's perhaps a little unique for each of us, and we need to take the time to find that way, because that is what will excite us and make us jump out of bed in the morning, like you and I do, anxious for the opportunity of working for another day.
You know, I think some of the response that they would have probably never have understood what was meant by the next statement. The people who said, you know, Russell, how could you sell your business? How could you do this? Well, if you hadn't sold it, it was the business and the unhappiness that caused the immune system to get thrown off to be able to allow the cancer to come in. And if you hadn't sold the business, you'd probably be dead right now.
Michael, I had a dream that I was in the casket in the church. And I'm laying there, and the minister was pointing at me, and he said he was a great insurance agent. Now, Michael, you were a great insurance agent at one point, and I hope I was also, but I knew my legacy wasn't to be a great insurance agent. And right then and there, I knew there was more for me to do than to be a great insurance agent. And I had to find that. Now, I will tell you, I had an 80-year-old father, and he was third generation, and I was fourth generation, and I own the business, but yet you never morally own a family business. And I had to explain to an 80-year-old man why I was going to sell a business on its anniversary. I had to explain to the rest of my family why I was going to go off and do something new. And there's not always as much encouragement and support as you would like. And I think the people need to know that they have to follow their inner true north and not just do what other people expect of them.
Now, Russell, that would, that would have been a tough thing to do. And just to get the full value of anybody listening, that you walked in, you told your family, you weren't selling an insurance business, you were selling a family legacy. Now, that was a tough one to get over.
Fourth generation, I sold it on its 100th anniversary.
Wow.
And Michael, it took me a couple of years. I knew I had to do it, and I did it very methodically, and I talked about it. I explained the reasons why. So it was not a quick, rash movement, but yet it was a very difficult one for family members who were not in the business to understand. But you have to be true to yourself. When your gut guides you and you know you're doing what you're meant to do, you've just got to continue and do it.
I know, Russell, we're starting to run out of time now. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, I do. I have www.bethebestyoucanbe.net.
Wonderful. Bethebestyoucanbe.net. And by the way, it'll be up on our website if anybody missed it. And also, can we buy the book there?
You can buy the book there, and if you buy it within the next 24 hours, you will get the workbook at no additional cost.
wonderful. It's be the best you can be, and it's all spelled out. Hey, Russell Shippey, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Michael. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
I know.
Said some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how...
Dennis Smith with us. He's the author of A Decade of Hope, Stories of Grief and Endurance from 9/11 Families and Friends. He's a former New York City firefighter and founder of the Firehouse Magazine, the largest circulating magazine for firefighters in the world. He's the author of 15 books, including four bestsellers. Report from Engine Number 82 has sold over 3 million copies in 13 languages. And Report from Ground Zero debuted at number 2 in the New York Times bestseller list. He's maintained at the forefront of the first responder community following the attacks on the World Trade Center. He's published a number of op-ed pieces covering a wide array of post 9/11 issues and sites on the board of Tribute, the interim memorial of the World Trade Center. And let us say, Dennis, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so very much for asking me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Dennis, when we really come down to it, 9/11 is so critically important to the culture that we live in, the history of this country in and of itself. Have we given it enough attention? Have we given it enough attention in a way that really supports and honors it?
Well, you know, I do think that we have given it a lot of attention, and sometimes the attention was, the motivations for the attentions were mixed. And so consequently, since there is not a directly straightforward a view of 9/11 that the mythology, you know, will be a little mixed going forward. When I say that, I mean, I think people think, well, you know, the firefighters and the police officers and the Port Authority police officers who acted so valiantly and courageously and were killed, and all of those people who were in those buildings were killed. We're really uncertain as to where the problem that was causal in 9/11 resides.
Now, by the way, Dennis, let me interrupt you for a minute, one of the most important things that we can really deal with, my goodness, my heart and everybody's heart goes out to those people who were killed. And it wasn't just an effect on the United States. They attacked a basically global economy with the kind of businesses that were in those buildings. But what about the survivors? What about those people who had to live on with that hurt in their heart and the losses that they sustained? Those are the people we should be concerned about, and those are the people we should have paid attention to.
Well, I think that we have paid attention to them, and certainly in this book, I sought to get a balanced view of those people. Don't forget there were 2,974 people killed, and so that's a lot of families. I had
25 interviews in this book, and I tried to balance it in religions and you know, wealth and race, and so that you get a view of what generally all of those people went through. And what I came away with really was that these people were inspiring. They're people of great character. They decided that they weren't going to sit back in a closet and weep for the rest of their lives, that they were going to try to, you know, create some betterment in the world around them. And so these stories, I feel, are very inspiring in that way. But, I mean, you're right. There is lots of grief and lots of suffering. And we talk about the 10th anniversary all the time, and it is a milestone date. But for these families, you know, I got to say, every day is the milestone. Every day is another day of absence. And it's very difficult for them.
I remember that day very well. As a matter of fact, I remember in the morning, I was up in Fairbanks, Alaska at the time, and I remember in the morning, I think it was 4 or 5 o'clock our time, you know, when it started, and I was watching, riveted to everything that was going on. That day I got to the radio station and did what I did, and then I came back. I was syndicated out of Arizona at the time, and I spent the entire day getting information and finding things out, and I was fine all the way up to the time, and I can even feel it now, that I got to some of the people that were actually had businesses there, some of the financial institutions, and the people that they had lost that day, and the confusion and the things that were going on. One woman also in the media that I was talking to, her husband was downtown. He was in New York City at the time, and she couldn't find him. So, you know, all of those things were going on. It is a morning and a day that I will never forget. Now, what about you? Where were you when this happened?
Well, I arrived there. I went down to a local firehouse as soon as I heard about it, and we commandeered a bus, about 14 other firefighters and I. And we asked the people on the bus to leave. It was very dramatic. And we took that bus down to Ground Zero. And as we were a few blocks away, literally, the second building fell down. And then, you know, I stayed there for 57 days. And, you know, of course, I wrote report from Ground Zero. And that gave me an understanding of that day, which I think is pretty comprehensive. And also it gave me a place and a time to develop a lot of very close friendships that have developed in the last 10 years. And those friendships then, you know, enabled me really to identify the right people to interview, the right 25 people to interview for this book, so that the book was meaningful.
Now, by the way, what was your takeaway? When I say what was your takeaway, when it was all over and done, through your eyes, what did it mean to you? What was the essence of the meaning of the entirety of the 9/11 incident?
Well, I mean, you know, aside from the fact that I lost so many people I knew, and I went to, you know, 30-odd funerals in 2 months, aside from the grief, my takeaway, I think it was that we were at war, and it was a turning point in the lives of everybody in the world. As you said before, the attack, you know, created financial chaos, but that's not why they attacked us. They didn't care about the financial chaos. What they cared about was killing a great number of Americans so that they could, you know, send that signal that they are dangerous, that they are hateful, that they hate us. To think with the death of bin Laden that Al-Qaeda is dead is a mistake. And so that's what I brought away. So I brought away, you know, after 9/11, I said to myself, Dennis, how much do you know about Islam and the history of Islam? And I realized it was pathetically little. So I went and, you know, and I read starting with Bernard Lewis's books, I read, I mean, probably 30 books on the history of Islam, and the Quran as well, which I read several times, just to educate myself about why that somebody could radicalize this religion and kill so many people with such wantonness. In you know, supposedly in the name of a god, it's got to be a really mean god, but that's what they claimed. So this is my own inadequacy, and I determined that you know, if you're going to be prepared, I learned this in the emergency service business. You know, I worked in the busiest firehouse in the world for many years, so I've been in a lot of burning buildings in my life. And I learned that without preparation, without knowing what you're doing, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. And this is why, when I recognized how little I knew about Islam, I really recognized that I was in trouble as a United States citizen.
Now, by the way, when it comes down to it, you know, your own personal opinion, I'm so tired of, and there are so many people today tired of, if you say something, you know, you're a bigot, you're a racist, and you don't know anything. And it's a way to keep people quiet and not being able to express. That's the one thing we have in this country, or had, was the ability to express. What is your feeling of, and you know this is going to probably come up tonight, but what is your feeling about a mosque being built right there at the center of all that horror?
Well, let me tell you, there are a couple of things, if I could tell you. You know, I could speak for several hours on the subject. The Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister of England, in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, said that people should recognize that Islam is the number one problem facing the world, and the number two problem facing in the world that everyone is afraid to talk about, the number one problem.
Yeah.
And he's right. You know, we have a political correctness that is not entirely wrong. You know, I mean, I think we have to be considerate of people, and we can't just make blanket statements about 1.5 billion people living in the world who practice a certain religion.
Sure.
You have to look very carefully at the founding, going back to the Islamic Brotherhood and those kinds of things. We are not adequately understanding the nature of Islam. When that mosque was first proposed by Imam Ruiz, his father was a known member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Not that the apple it falls close to the tree, or you should be responsible for your father's actions, but he was, and that's known. Roof announced the building of a mosque there, two blocks north of the North Tower of the World Trade Center. It was then resented by a great many people because what everyone failed to recognize in this was that over 1,200 people had never been found, not a fingernail, not a single piece of body to DNA. And where are those bodies? I mean, I was there that morning. You know, I spent the whole morning there and that whole day and that whole night. And so where were they? They were in the air. And where was the air? The air was where it fell. You know, that dust is where those bodies fell. And to build a mosque in that area was just grossly insensitive and arrogant. And the mayor came out and defended it in, I thought, the most pretentious way, you know, standing in front of the Statue of Liberty and talking about freedom. And no one ever denied their right to build that mosque. Never. I never heard a single person deny the right. What they said, what people were saying, is that this is really insulting to a great many families who have lost people in this attack by Muslim radicals. And to build a Muslim mosque in the same property where that air fell, where those 1,200 missing bodies were in the air, was just absolutely. And also, you know, there was a piece of the engine of the airplane was on the roof of that building when the airplanes crashed. So it just is really terrible. And I wonder if the unions are going to build that building. I wonder if, you know, Imam Roof is going to raise the money to build that building. It was 3 weeks later after there was such an outcry of resentment and outrage, really, of building this mosque, that Imam Roof decided not to call it a mosque any longer, but an Islamic cultural center.
Wonderful.
You know, that is the it just adds, this kind of hypocrisy just adds to the outrage.
Well, that's a slap. That part of it is truly a slap in the face. Dennis, we're just about out of time, but let me tell you, I'm totally on your side of the table with everything that you just said. It would have sounded like the words coming out of my mouth across the board. Now, let me ask you this. Website we can find you so we can buy the book.
Oh, I Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com, I think. That's just look for Dennis Smith or A Decade of Hope.
Wonderful. Hey, Dennis, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Mike, for asking me. I appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be.
Tiffany Lynn Carroll's with us. She's the author of Shush, Smiles, Have Your Secrets Hidden. Tiffany was born February 13th, 1989, grew up in Dairy Farm outside small town with Bruxelles in Manitoba, and she loved spending years on the farm, learning more every day and working as a family to keep the farm growing. Now, she moved to Winnipeg, Manitoba for college, graduating with honors in tourism management at Red River College in 2010. She's currently working her way through towards a professional photography degree, enjoying every bit of knowledge that she gains. Her passions are reading, writing, photography, which consume most of her spare time when she's not spending weekends on the farm. This is her first published book and hopes to continue on with her writing dreams. And let's say, Tiffany, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I got to tell you, you started a fight right before the show went on. I said, shh, and Radio Susie looked at me and says, who are you telling to shut up? I said, no, it's the name of the book.
Oh, that's funny.
Now, let me ask you this. What was it that caused you to write this book? What was it that you wanted people to know?
Well, this was my third attempt at writing the book. And what I really felt like, before, when I tried writing it, I felt like it was too early and I wasn't ready to express myself. And then this third time, I set up a publisher because I really wanted to get it done and set a goal for myself. And the whole point of it was to help myself. And I felt like if I had someone be so honest to me about the whole situation, that it would have helped me out a bit more throughout my struggles.
Now, by the way, with the bulimia, the depression, cutting, you know, there's so many kids that do that today. The bulimia and the depression, what started that? Are you aware of, when it started, but what caused it? What brought it on?
I know the depression started as a child, and I didn't know.
I'll go my way by myself. This is the end of romance. I'm gonna go my way. Bye.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
It's only a dance. I'll try to apply myself.
Lisa Patterson with us. She's the author of Inner Growth, Reaching the Middle Ground. It's a workbook. She's a life intuitive coping skill that she learned from childhood and then perfected through her inner growth in adulthood. Her intuitive work and her unique ability to perform house clearings have been featured in numerous publications, including Straight Talk Radio in Seattle, San Jose Mercury News, The Connection Magazine, and the Sacramento Bee, and so much more. Lisa, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. What is an intuitive? Let's lay a base and then build from there, okay?
Well, an intuitive is one who has clairvoyant abilities. In other words, they can see things in their mind's eye. Clairsentience, where I get feelings, sensations, feelings about different issues. And clairaudience, sometimes I'll hear things in my mind. So I put all those together, and that's what I'm calling intuitive.
Now, what is a house clearing?
A house clearing is something that I do remotely. I don't have to go into the home. I simply have my client on the phone or on Skype, and I take a look at their questions. I talk to them about what's going on in their home, whether they've been having difficulty selling it, or maybe they're just not feeling comfortable in their home. And as they talk to me, different pictures and feelings and or different things I might hear, but those pictures can light up in their energy field. And oftentimes what I find, especially with houses that haven't been sold or the discomfort, is that there are feelings that are stuck in their homes that are their feelings, but they've disowned them. So I help clear all those out and give them some suggestions as to things they can do to own their home better and thereby attract a buyer or attract more harmony in their home.
Now, by the way, is the feeling an energy vibration that just hangs out?
Yes, it is. It leaves an imprint.
Yeah.
And sometimes you may have gone into a restaurant or a home, and you can feel that there's tension, or maybe there's been an angry argument just before. And you can sense it when you walk in there. And that's what I can do. And that's something I gleaned as a survival tool in my early years.
Now, by the way, when you grew up, you said your family was plagued by spirits and then alcoholic spirits. But when you say plagued by spirits, were there spirits in the house? Were there other spirits than the family?
Well, yes, there were. But when I said that, I meant more alcoholic spirits, because when it comes to alcohol, they call it spirits because there are spirits with alcohol. In fact, with every different drug, there are spirits that go along with them. And sometimes they're mischievous, and sometimes they're mean, and sometimes they're playful. But they're always spirits that kind of latch on, and they sort of almost become having a life of their own through the person by way of their alcoholism or their drinking or their drugging. It's a
now, Lisa,
really
our entire makeup, we're an electrochemical factory. And obviously the world is built around vibrations. Music is a vibration. You can feel it, you can experience
yes.
it. If I said to you, Lisa, let's dance, and there was a certain music, we'd fall into that vibration for that moment while we're dancing. So let me ask
That's right.
you this. When you talk about the alcohol experience, if I drink a lot of alcohol, and it changes my body chemistry. There's a lot of dopamine, the feel good stuff, and maybe I don't want to look at things and I use the alcohol. But once I started drinking the alcohol, my entire chemistry begins to change. If my chemistry changed, then my vibration changes. And if my vibration changes, does that allow that spirit that has that same vibration to hook up with me?
It can happen that way. There's a lot of ways it can happen. It does change your frequency. It can also make you leave your body. And that's what I see happen most of the time. And when you leave your body, something else will come into it. It's just the way it is. We're supposed to be in our bodies.
All right. So if you're not there, somebody's going to take up that residence.
Yes. Something or someone.
Okay, and now, is that what was happening to you?
No, it was happening to my parents.
Ah, okay, all right. Okay.
It was happening to my parents, but what was happening to me was I was developing a very keen sense of awareness of their feeling level and what was going on in them. And it was allowing me to do things like, before I'd leave school as a child, I would look into the energy ethers at my mother to see if she was depressed. And if she was, then I would know to go to my friend's house where I could have fun and be happy. So it allowed me a greater ability to sense danger also and to sense feelings. I'm very good at feelings.
Okay, now the feelings when you sense them, does that cause that those probing questions to get to the essence of whatever it is that there's a problem at that moment with that person?
Well, it can, and now with the workbook, it's a little different. What I'm talking about with the workbook is I'm talking about people going inside and looking at what their family script was and how it impacts them today in their life now. Is it positive? Is it negative? And so in the workbook, I ask very specific questions, lots of different questions, in order for them to dig in and answer honestly for themselves so that they can make changes. Because what I believe is that everything in life is created by our choices and our consequences to those choices.
Sure.
Like my parents chose to drink, and there were consequences. And so if you really look at your choices and the consequences, then you can get a greater handle on a kind of life that you want to create. It's very powerful.
But is it looking outside of what you think is possible? There are so many choices people have, but let's say you walk into someone's realm of existence and you point things out that they didn't see. Now, all of a sudden, they have the ability to make a choice that they didn't even know existed for them. And sometimes it takes that looking over your shoulder, somebody else looking over your shoulder and seeing what you don't see. And there was that old adage about if you ask the wrong questions, you get the right answers for the wrong questions, you don't get anywhere. But if you can intuitively work on the right questions and you get the right answers, and then people begin to see, they begin to open up and see what wasn't there before.
Well, and invariably in those situations, what happens with those kinds of things where I'll suggest something is happening or this is going on, Well, what I notice is that they have a little aha moment, and they go, well, you're right. I did feel that. I did sense that, but I didn't trust myself. And so a lot of times that's what it's about. They did know, they were intuitive, but they didn't trust themselves. Yeah. So my pointing it out simply allows them to trust more, to trust themselves more.
You know what I'm hearing? Excuse me. What I'm hearing is they needed permission. If you don't trust yourself, you need somebody to give you permission.
Yes.
Basically what you're doing is you're giving them permission.
Yes, and most likely in their family of origin, they learned how to not trust their own intuition, sometimes their own choices, sometimes their own thoughts or beliefs.
Yeah, because being wrong is...
They didn't get validated.
Well, being wrong is a bad thing. You know, that's a horrible thing that I just said, but most people live their life like that. They'll do anything not to be wrong. And that comes from childhood.
Right.
That comes from the judgments, that we are going through. And if you're confident,
the fear
in yourself,
of abandonment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, mm-hmm. Because what do we strive for? We strive for acceptance. What does acceptance give us? Acceptance gives us identity. And if you're afraid to lose your identity because you don't agree with somebody, that's probably most people's story.
Yes. That's right. That's right.
And it's called go beyond that. And I would venture to guess that most people are intuitive, but they're frightened to death of it, so they won't allow themselves to experience it.
Yeah, and it's sad because it's one of the gifts that we're all born with. I mean, our brains are so huge. Our abilities are, I just think they're almost, you might say infinite if we simply would trust them and allow it, but we're given so much.
Yeah,
we just need to be aware of it.
Okay, let's define something. Middle ground. What is the middle ground?
Well, the middle ground territory is where what I call when you are making your choices based on knowing your thoughts, knowing your feelings, knowing what your needs and your wants are. It's much easier to choose middle ground experiences rather than the all or nothing zones. Mm-hmm. And you know, for example, maybe you went to the bar, maybe you had a couple drinks, just a couple, and then you decide, well, I'm going to go ahead and drive home now. And you've told yourself, well, I'm fine. I've just had a couple. And then you get pulled over. And so you fooled yourself. You fooled yourself by thinking, well, you only had a couple, so you're fine. All of a sudden, you're in one of the extreme zones, getting extreme reactions, consequences.
Yeah, but how about those people that are out there that do that intentionally? They need to get caught to prove themselves right about themselves. I really think deep down inside of everybody, there is that neutral place that there's nothing wrong with you. You're there. It's good. There's nothing wrong. But then as we grow, we start to learn, well, there might be something wrong. And I think what we do, from my experience now, is there's two voices inside of you. The first voice is that noisy voice that says, you can't, you're going to die, you're going to this, you're going to that. And that's the first voice that most people get frightened of. But if you get quiet, and I don't mean you have to meditate on a mountain for 2 hours, but if you get quiet, that other noisy voice will go away, and you can start to hear the other voice, which is below that one, that's got your truth.
And I call that checking in.
Okay.
Checking into your inner world, and sometimes I'll even suggest that people put their hand on their chest, close their eyes, and check in and ask yourself if that's something that you want to do, or is that something you want to say, or what do you need, feel, or want in that moment? That's what I call that. And that is intuitive also.
Sure.
I think our feelings are our bridge to the intuition.
Yeah. But I really believe also that feelings are a chemical reaction too. You know, there was that old adage that, you know, when you want to talk to somebody, you feel their pain. That's old school. That's history. That's not the way that it worked. There's so much brain science that is happening today, the neurosciences, that you begin to realize
yes.
that based on past experience, that trigger of something is going to cause an emotion based on an old experience. So feelings, et cetera, are something that are created through the chemistry of your body, either to sit back and love or to jump up and protect yourself.
That's exactly right. Yes. And another interesting thing you mentioned about chemicals in the body, sometimes different foods or drink will create digestive disturbances that will affect our emotional state and create disharmony and create feelings that we wouldn't normally have. Usually it's fear.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
And fear, it's automatic. It's not something that you think about. It could be within a millisecond. You walk into a room, you see somebody that for some reason you don't like, or they remind you of somebody, but you're not thinking this, and you get that little tension in you. Or you walk into the room and see something, you just get something mushy. It's all the same thing.
And I think that's important to listen to.
Sure.
Because it could be a message.
Oh, total agreement. Total agreement.
Yeah,
it's nothing more than one message after another. And if you don't look at it, it's the, you know, people call them lessons. I'll call them gifts. And some people call them blessings. It's that when life is just as bad as it can be and you're right up against the wall, if you just close your eyes for a second and do exactly what you were talking about and ask the right question, you get to see what it is that you're supposed to be seeing. If you don't see it, it's going to come back and again and again and again in every kind of a different shape and form and everything until you finally see it.
It's true. We get so many chances to do the right thing, to follow what our intuitive guide tells us. And when we don't follow it, I call that making withdrawals out of our personal trust account.
No, I hear
and
that.
When we do follow it, I call it deposits into our trust account. And when we make enough deposits, it builds self-esteem and it makes our intuition grow.
I totally am on the same page with you. We're running out of time. Lisa, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, I do. It's inner-growth.net.
Inner-growth.net. And if anybody missed it, it's going to be up on our website. Lisa Patterson, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much, Michael. I enjoyed it.
Great. Good night.
Bye-bye now.
Promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking, can you turn me
to write this book? What was it that you wanted people to know?
Well, this was my third attempt at writing the book, and what I really felt like before. When I tried writing it, I felt like it was too early and I wasn't ready to express myself. And then this third time, I set up a publisher because I really wanted to get it done and set a goal for myself. And the whole point of it was to help myself. And I felt like if I had someone be so honest to me about the whole situation, that it would have helped me out a bit more throughout my struggles.
Now, by the way, with the bulimia, the depression, cutting, you know, that's, there's so many kids that do that today. The bulimia and the depression, what started that? Do you have, are you aware of, well, A, when it started, but what caused it? What brought it on?
I know the depression started as a child, and I didn't notice it until I hit my high school years. So in grade 9, the depression brought on the bulimia and the cutting as a way of coping with what I was feeling.
Now, by the way, when we talk about coping and depression, most people don't know how to cope with depression. When it comes on, you have no idea what started it, and it affects obviously so many phases and parts of your life. What was it like? What was it like in school with that? What was it like with your friends? What was going on?
I was always, my mind was always working because I was always reminding myself to just be strong and be happy in front of everyone else because I didn't want to drag anyone else down because I knew what it felt being down. So I didn't want to put anyone in that situation, and I didn't want anyone treating me any differently. So I wanted to hide it and just keep it from them.
Now, by the way, in cutting, you know, and I know there's so many kids that do that. What brings that on? Is that a pain that's worse than the pain that you're going through? Is that a way to move away from the depression?
For me, the cutting was a release. When everything felt so built up, it felt, when I cut, it's like it let all the pressure out and I could breathe again and think properly again.
Okay, now, by the way, how long did it take for that to stop? What was the correlating factor that caused that to diminish and go away eventually?
It took at least 7 years.
Yeah.
But it was, You had to fight off the urges. You had to find something else to do. For me to stop the cutting, I had to leave my house because that's where I could cut. So I just leave the house until the feeling went away.
Now, by the way, when you anybody in a similar situation like that, when you get into that kind of a let's call it a pattern because it is a pattern. What about people trying to help you? I've noticed that you refuse help. You push people away. What causes that? Was there any way that you were calling out for help, or were they not recognizing it?
No, I truly feel that you can't get help from anyone else until you actually want to help yourself. Because no matter, my family, we're really close, and they wanted to help me and tried to help me as much as they could. But I wasn't ready to get help, and I wasn't ready to give up the cutting or the bulimia.
Okay, now, by the way, with the bulimia, obviously you were getting very, very, very thin. Was there any other health problems attached to it?
I'd get a few ulcers in my stomach. My mouth, my teeth were very sensitive, factors like that. It wasn't anything too crazy.
No, and I hear you very loud and clear. What about medication? You know, when depression in and of itself is something that most people have no idea what it is. Even some of the professionals have a hard time getting a handle on it for most people. So what do? You're depressed. You can't move through it. You medicate. Now, what about medication and depression?
I was willing to take it to try. I was very against it throughout the years. I was on and off it quite a few times. I flushed the medication a few times. I thought if I wanted to be happy, I didn't need to take a pill to make me happy. That's the way I was looking at it. But as I am now, I'm on the medication, and I find with the medication, it helps, but just taking a pill isn't going to make it go away. There's so much more to it. You still have to open up, you have to talk to somebody, and you have to actually figure out what the problem is.
Now, I know that now that you're working with parents, obviously, to recognize some of the symptoms. Is it that well hidden? Do parents really go about their daily lives and not notice there's a problem until it's too late?
I believe so. I believe if the person really wants to hide it, they'll get so used to hiding it, it'll become very easy for them. Over the years, it became very easy for me to hide. Even when it came out to my family that I was bulimic and cutting, I could still do it without them noticing. So it's kind of like if there's a will, there's a way. You'll find a way to do it if you really want to without someone knowing it.
But what about school? And then when I say what about school, did you hide your depression in school? Did they know that you were depressed?
No, they didn't.
Ah, okay. Now, I'm going to play a role here. I'm a parent, and I have a child that's 14, 15, 16 years old, younger, maybe a little older. what am I going to look for? What will I see in that child that's going to trigger something in me to say, I better take a second look?
I'd probably watch for emotions more, or just being by yourself a lot, because I know I didn't want to interact very much, as little as I could, because it's hard pretending all day long. So I'd probably keep an eye on how much alone time they spend together. Maybe, depending on the cutting, we can hide it as much as we can, but you can always start to notice. Even with bulimia, you can start to notice, because I know my brother-in-law noticed in my eyes a lot. They'd be bloodshot or something, and he was the first one to recognize something.
Oh, now, okay, now, when he recognized something, what did he say? Who did he say it to? How did they bring? How did your family bring it out into the open?
They didn't bring it out into the open right away. He let my sister know, and that's before I brought it out. So he had let my sister know kind of what he was thinking, and then later on when I brought it out, she saw that he was right.
Okay, now, when you what caused you to finally bring it out?
An accident.
Isn't that the way it always happens?
I was talking to one of my brother's friends that was going through what I was going through, and she became concerned for me and ended up telling him, and it was just the process. He told my sister, and then she confronted me, and we went on from there.
All right. Now, when she confronted you, was that easy for you to handle?
No, I was rather upset. Yeah. I wasn't ready to open up yet. I didn't want everybody to know yet. So it was kind of difficult going through, because then we had to tell my mom, and it was the whole basis on me for trying to explain myself to everybody and why I was doing it.
Oh, sure. Now, by the way, how'd your mom deal with it? You know, your sister's going to be one thing, but now all of a sudden your mom is, that's a whole different story. How'd your mom handle it?
My parents were in denial for a long time. They didn't want to believe it because from what they saw, everything was fine. So it took them a while, but slowly they opened up more, and she started to try and learn more about it. She'd go on the internet, and like I said, I was difficult, so I didn't open up very much for her. So she was really trying to find out as much information as she could to try and help me as it went on. And lots of the times when she'd ask me if I'm okay, is everything going good, I could say yes and she'd believe me and I could just keep going. Because in a way, when I said yes, she just wanted it all to be over for me.
Was there any time that your parents thought that maybe it was their fault? Did you run into that at all? No, go ahead, because there's usually a lot of guilt, and then they'll bring it back on themselves, you know, what could I have done different, etc. So did you run into that at all?
I think earlier on they ran into it, but at this point they know they did what they could, because I know I had an overdose, and I know my dad thought it was his fault. So they have had a little bit, they've had guilt throughout, but at this point they understand that they did what they could do to help me with what I gave them.
Yeah, no, I hear you loud and clear. We're starting to run out of time. Tiffany, do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Yes, it's TiffanyLCarls.com.
Okay, one more time.
TiffanyLCarls.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Tiffany, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
You'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away.
you're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. I'm the one I need. Yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you now, some of these days,
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Michael Scott with us, a professor in the Department of Geography and Geosciences at Salisbury University. He's also the graduate director of the Master of Science in GIS Management Program, as well as the director of the Eastern Shore Regional GIS Cooperative. He has a PhD in geography from the University of South Carolina, specializing in environmental hazards and GIS. He's also had over 15 years of experience applying GIS and modeling to solve environmental hazards problems. And Michael, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Michael Ray.
I bet you've been popular in the last week or so.
It's been a little busy, to be honest.
I imagine that. What do you think, Mike? What do you think caused this?
Oh, well, that's a good question. We're probably going to be working on trying to figure that out for some time. Our best guess, because it's not always as clear for East Coast earthquakes as it is for West Coast.
Sure.
For East Coast earthquakes, we think the most likely cause is both leftover energy in the crust from when the Appalachian Mountains formed about 200 million years ago is a big cause. And then the other one is what we call isostatic rebound. And basically the simple answer is that about 15,000 years ago, we had the end of the Little Ice Age. And, of course, across the top of our continent, across Canada, New York, Maine, Vermont, all of those areas were covered in glaciers. That put a lot of weight on the continent at the north end and actually basically tilted it to the north. And ever since those glaciers melted, the continent has been slowly, slowly tipping back down to the south. And so that also causes rocks to move, and when those rocks to move, all of a sudden we get an earthquake.
Now, I was brought up in Los Angeles, and my goodness, you know, I was weaned on earthquakes. I was in it was a big one in 1952, and any of the earthquakes that followed, and I left in 83, and I ended up in the interior of Alaska, and somewhere in the 90s, I was sitting in the gym one morning, and we could hear the rattle of all those weight plates, and they got louder and louder, and we realized we're in the middle of an earthquake. So, but it was a completely different kind of an earthquake than it was in the Los Angeles area. Now, isn't there a fault line in New York also, somewhere in that vicinity, that they're waiting someday that thing's going to hit?
Yeah, there are a number of what we call relic faults. So faults not active, there's not a lot, in fact none, really active faulting going on in the eastern part of the United States. All those faults, and there are plenty that are there, but most of them are older. They're from an earlier time period when the Appalachian Mountains were forming. And so they've got their eye on a couple of them. And this one in Virginia that took place last week, that's an area where we know has had seismic activity before. But usually when they have them, again, a lot of times it's not necessarily, particularly with this one, you couldn't put your finger on and go, oh, that's the fault line that came from. For example, your experience in Los Angeles, and both Los Angeles and Alaska, setting the volcano-created earthquakes aside in Alaska, but the fault-created earthquakes, it's very clear that, you know, okay, there's the fault, and we can expect that we can actually measure the stress and try to figure out exactly how much stress those faults are under. And in the East Coast, it's much more hidden.
Well, sure, and it's a different kind of a quake. The one in the Los Angeles area of Southern California, actually, when that hit, it was very shaky, very rigid ground. The one in Alaska, it would sway. It was completely, it's a completely different kind of a quake. And if somebody has not been in an earthquake and it's their very first experience, Michael, it's scary. And when I say it's scary, because you can't run away from it. There's nothing to do. You just have to wait it out.
Absolutely. No, nowhere to go. That's right.
No, none at all.
Yeah, in fact, we actually saw that and people watching the news with the earthquake last week, you can see that sort of panic in people as they run outside, for example, from the building that they're in as it's swaying or moving. And of course, what we try to tell people is that is exactly what you don't want to do, because that's a lot of our injuries and deaths from earthquakes come from where people ran outside, and then stuff from the upper floors of buildings, unreinforced masonry or plate glass or whatever it happens to be, falls down on them and hurts them. So, and it's just that comes from the fact that we're not in the East Coast in particular. You know, we have anywhere between 40 and 50 earthquakes any given year here in the Mid-Atlantic alone. But most of them are so small that you can't feel them at all. Or if you do feel them, it's very slight and it's very localized. To get a large-ish quake like the one we got last week, that's felt by a lot of people, and actually you can see things swaying in the lab where we are. We're on the Delmarva Peninsula, about halfway between the Atlantic Ocean and Chesapeake Bay. In our building alone.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love who's burning like.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have.
Kathy Nelson coming up next.
And a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return here, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Popular speaker, executive coach, and author Kathy Nelson with us. She's the founder of Kathy Nelson LLC ConnectWorks. Her latest book is 28-Day Plan to More Profits. Her Fast Track Online Learning Community launches in September, actually. Wait, September, October, we're still there. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the show.
I'm here.
I know, I love it. I'm just trying to figure out what month is September, but I realize we're in it. I said, your online learning community launches the Fast Track in September. And I said, oh, we're in September. Did you launch it yet?
We are in September. It launches later this month. That's coming up.
Wonderful. Good. Now, by the way, 28-day plan to more profit. I guess one of the big things that are going on today, more and more people are starting to learn what the word entrepreneur means. They have outsourced the bigger companies, and it's got to a point where people are being let go. And the power of a computer is unbelievable today. People are starting their own businesses. One of the biggest problems I think that they do have, Kathy, is there's so many people afraid of themselves, and they just don't know what it takes to do it. And I really believe that people like yourself who've been there and done it, if you can symbolically hold people's hands, it's got to be a great way to go.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of my favorite things in the whole world. I believe everybody has not only were they born with gifts and talents, but boy, when you combine that with your experience and, you know, your personal history, that whatever drives your passion, it can really make a powerful business message and, you know, delight in everything you do. And of course, then delight on the customer's end because you're doing what you do best.
Small businesses, you know, there was a time when there was a pretty good size failure rate only because of the major corporations until they got involved with global competition. But being in business for yourself, a small business today, especially with the internet, when you've got that kind of connection and with the Facebooks and the LinkedIn and so on and so forth, a person can really get out there and do some things, can't they?
Absolutely, Michael. And one of the interesting things about it is that, you know, the failure rate in business these days is still, actually, according to statistics, it is not that changed, except that it really doesn't reflect some of the numbers, the reasons why people are leaving business, or, you know, it doesn't count for those work-at-home moms who are only working when their kids are getting ready for school, or those that are in between jobs. So when you think about the internet and LinkedIn and giving sole proprietors or small business owners greater visibility and credibility in the market, there's some pretty incredible opportunity, because what customers are looking for is proven experience and a track record and the fact that you can deliver. They're not necessarily looking for that big corporate infrastructure. Plus, they've experienced that it adds a lot of overhead to the pricing and actually decreases some of the deliverability of good products and services when it comes to the services and products arena.
You know, one of the things that I found is, you know, that somebody has, you know, a great idea, and they go home and they create that great idea, and Kathy, they're starting to make some money from it. There comes a time when they get a little bit larger, and they have to augment their skills. They need other people there to help them out because they can't do it by themselves. I think that in and of itself should be a training module or a training process, only because there are people that get there and sometimes their ego won't allow them to have somebody else tell them how something is done. And I am of the opinion, and I have been for many, many years now, that if you've got a business and you bring somebody in, you want that person to know more than you do.
Michael Ray, that's actually, you know, one of the truisms that we hear from many successful leaders today, is that absolutely you want to hire up. But one of the challenges for entrepreneurs is that part of what gets them into business is that do-it-yourself mentality. You know, they're smart. I call it the smart people syndrome. You know, they're smart and they figure things out. They're great and they're resourceful. But there does come a point when their business grows beyond themselves. And the ability to be self-aware, to be able to set aside your ego, to realize that there are things that you don't even know that you don't know, and that someone else is better at. And it's almost counterintuitive at times if you've grown up or, you know, you've matured yourself from that do-it-yourself mentality, that you have to let go of some things that you do good to do the things you do exceptionally so that other people can show up and do the things they do exceptionally, and everybody can grow.
Sure.
It's an interesting transition. Yeah. I work with a lot of people at that phase, as well as experience it myself every time I go through a growth phase.
Well, no, and collaboration is extremely important. But one of the issues that you bring up, which I think is critical because of the economy today, it's never too late. You can be a senior citizen and go into business for yourself today.
As a matter of fact, the senior citizens and, you know, what's in that boomer generation are going to business for themselves at a significantly increased rate, in part because they're able to self-fund their new venture. So the risk at times seems less to them, as well as they're able to move into things they really enjoy and make it work around their schedule. What I appreciate about that is watching people who have started later in life and really become successful and been able to significantly contribute, which is kind of what you move to in that latter stage of life, is, you know, you've done all the work and doing things you don't like to do. You want to do things that will make a difference.
Okay, now let me ask you this. I've got my pencil out here. 5 questions to ask yourself before you leave a job for entrepreneurship. I think that's extremely important. So I got my pencil out. Let's see if I'm ready.
Okay, you ready? Well, the number one question I always make sure that we're asking is, what is your motivation? Why do you want to leave your job? Is it to be your own boss? Do you think you have the idea for a better mousetrap? Are you doing it so you make more money? You've got to be really clear on what your motivation is. And any one of those, I mean, it could have been any one of those answers or more, but you've got to be crystal clear on what it is. Because sometimes when you start your own business, you actually are becoming your own worst boss. So it's a very enlightening question. So number two is, the question to ask yourself is, what is my unique offering? Because if I'm going to go out and start a business, I want to know that I've got an edge. And to help my clients succeed, we find what that edge is. Because if you don't know what that is or who else is offering something similar, one of the comments I hear a lot is, there's nobody out there doing this thing that I want to do. And I'm putting that in quotes, this activity, sure, this service, this product that I want to do. And you know what we discover is that they're not using the right search terms when they're Googling it. They're unaware of actually that there are people doing it. They might be able to do it better differently with their experience, but it's almost like they don't know what they don't know.
Absolutely.
So really understanding what their unique offering is.
Yeah, you're talking about something called a value proposition, and it's why you're different.
Exactly.
Why your perfect customer will buy from you instead of the person down the street who has something similar to offer. And I would venture to guess that Kathy, I don't care how many people you ask. If you ask 100 people, 98% of those people are not going to be able to give you an answer.
Well, one of the things they don't realize, Michael Ray, is that sometimes the unique value they bring comes from their very life experience and their own personality and their own strength set. Because we're so focused on describing it in a way other people have described it in the past, we tend to stay away from some of that infusion of our personal experience and the deliverables that creates in an outcome. So we don't really get to that unique message, like you say, because we're kind of shying away from, we want to stand out, but we don't want to stand out too much.
Or they just, Kathy, they just don't know.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. Why are you different? And, you know, 20 minutes of pause, and you get kind of a little indication there that they don't know. Nothing wrong with that, but it's one of those things that if they don't get, there's a lot of business left on the table.
Exactly. Oh, you've got it. Well, the number three question I ask has to do with how much they're willing to work. Starting your own business is not a venture for the person who wants to sleep late, go to bed early, and vacation every day unless you're like Tim Ferriss and want to have a four-hour work week and use his model of outsourcing everything. You have to be willing to work. So usually the question I ask is, are you willing to work 50-plus hours a week? One of the interesting things about that is that the paradox that it doesn't feel like you're working when you're doing what you love to do. So it doesn't feel like you're working 50 hours a week. But there is some time investment to get ramped up and going in a business. And some people will say, actually, no, I'm not willing to do that. Well, then starting your own business is not for you.
Yeah, and by the way, I think that's a great answer for people, because if they're truly not willing, then you just said it, don't go into business.
And I've got a couple other questions that they kind of jump in priority between 5 and 8. And so one of the questions I would ask when you're leaving a business, can you afford to start your own business? There is a ramp-up time. There is, depending on what you're starting, there can be a pretty nominal investment to get started. That's one of the things I talk about. It's actually pretty easy to get started in business, especially if you're a service-based business you could probably get started in business for under $1,000. But can you afford the ramp-up time to get your processes in place and get your customer base built, all of the parts of your business going to ramp up to the income that you'd like to be getting? And depending on the business and depending on the niche that you're filling, variables in place, but it's always a good question.
Kathy, you bring up another interesting point. The See, you're old school. Now I know I like you, all right? It's because I call it a niche, too. Somewhere in the transition, the new word became niche, but it's niche. Anyhow, but that's something else, too. Finding that niche, finding that position of yourself within the marketplace, most people don't get that.
Well, and this ties into the other question we ask about your finding your unique offering or unique value proposition. Seth Godin has done boatloads for helping us all integrate the word tribe into our vocabulary into so much that it's almost an overused word, but people really get what that means. And there, I believe that if you are a passionate, purpose-driven business owner or entrepreneurial-minded person, you have a voice and an experience that there is a people group or a tribe that needs, they need you. Like, there's a tribe out there that needs me. You know, I've not only started 3 businesses, I've actually coached thousands of people to start their business that are very entrepreneurial, that are very do-it-yourself minded, many that are bootstrapping. You know, they're making the money to make the investment to make the growth to grow. And there are not very many business strategists or coaches out there who've actually done that. A lot of the coaches out in the arena have either come from corporate and they've pulled out of their 401k and they've started their practices, but they're not serial entrepreneurs who've actually started solid businesses. My first business was a telecom company, for goodness sake, you know, equipment and sales teams and technicians and all of that.
Sure.
You
know what I think?
So that thought of tying that into the tribe, you're right, it's important. That's kind of the new version for niche is where I was going with that. Sorry about that.
Yeah, and there's another thing to really get straight on when somebody is going to go out into the marketplace and they're going to present themselves, present whatever it is. There's an old example about wanting to, you're doing a project at home and you want a hole in the wall. So you go to the hardware store to get a drill, which is going to make the hole. And then the question, I won't ask you the question, but the question is, you know, are you buying the drill or are you buying the hole? Now, 85-90% of the people out there say, well, I'm buying the drill. That's not so. You're buying what the drill can do for you, which happens to be the hole. And you get most people in the marketplace, they're selling the drill, and they lose 80% of those potential people that could take advantage of their services because they're not selling what those people, what the drill means to those people, what it symbolizes, what it represents. And I think that is just a little bit of a shift that will cause people to be able to be successful out there. You're not selling a drill, you're selling what the drill can do. You're not selling a service, you're selling what the service can do. And that in and of itself is one of the most valuable lessons anybody marketing anything can hear.
Absolutely. Michael Ray, and it's interesting, you know, that you say that. I've been hearing that since I went to my first sales training, I think, 25 years ago. And, boy, that certainly pegs me, but I mean, I was a kid when I went. But to hear that then and to hear even still that's a gap, that there's a gap there. And what I've observed in the last 10 years of really doing this focused consulting work is that that's actually a maturity phase in our business.
Sure.
You know, when we start our business, we're pretty enamored with ourselves and our process and our service and our company. And so we are kind of stuck on the benefits and how it works versus the end result for the customer. But we mature to a point, and we can mature rapidly or we can beat our head against the wall for a long time until we go, you know, that's not working for me. And then we move to the other point, or we run into a coach who asks us the question and helps us get to that point of the discovery of saying, you know, let's talk about your customer's journey. And after you've worked with them, what is it that they hired you for in the first place? And what was the deliverable you created for them in that experience? And what were all the facets of that? And that actually gives you a much greater vocabulary to discuss your end results or your deliverable or the pain points when you're coming at it from the customer's perspective.
Oh, sure. But by the way, we're starting to run out of time, but the key here also, you just said something very important. What is it that you think that they bought from you? And I would venture to guess if you actually sat down with that customer, you're going to get a different answer than what you think it is. And it boils down to this. If you're married, you know, the proverbial question, did you fall in love with your husband or did you fall in love with the maid, the way that he made you feel, or reverse that? You didn't fall in love with him. You fell in love with the way he made you feel. 10 guys could have been standing there, but he was the one that caused that feeling within you. That's the drill in the hole. And with that, Kathy, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. The best place to check me out is connectpassiontoprofit.com. That's connectpassiontoprofit.com, all spelled out. We got a bunch of freebies there, and you can get right on the 28 Days to Profit plan for a free series of guides and tips on how to move into strengths-based business that grows.
Wonderful. Kathy, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time, and I think you're spot on. You're right on message.
Thank you so much, Michael Ray. Have a good evening.
Hey, good night.
Off comes the makeup, off comes the clown's disguise.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
The music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out.